Good morning. You're listening to 91.5 KUNV, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, Tobin LePan, reporter for the Las Vegas Sun. On July 4th, residents of Mount Charleston were forced to evacuate their small, close-knit communities as a fire that started on the eastern side of the Spring Mountains grew rapidly and threatened residences and other businesses. Nearly 2 weeks later, the fire is mostly contained but still burning, and the blaze touched approximately 28,000 acres. Today, we have Las Vegas Sun reporter Riley Snyder in the studio. Riley, thanks for joining us. Riley's been one of the reporters covering the fire for the Sun and was on duty on July 4th, the day the evacuation started, right? So, Riley, could you first talk, what started the fire?
The fire was started by a lightning strike, actually on July 1st. It kind of really escalated very quickly. On the 4th of July, they started with this initial notice of possible evacuations. It wasn't mandatory. And then from then on, from the night of July 4th onward, it just grew and grew and grew.
And then, so obviously, actually, I was up there on July 4th, and I was hiking. We didn't even know that there was any kind of fire up there, but it turned out some of the trails were closed. And when we started coming down, I think it was maybe like 3 in the afternoon, they started evacuating the mountain, but we had ash falling on our car and everything. And then, so how exactly did the fire progress? Like, what factors were leading to its spread and the way it sort of started to threaten, you know, buildings and all that stuff?
Yeah, I've talked to a couple of wildlife experts with the Forest Service, and basically what they've said is that this kind of fire will hit this area about once every couple of hundred years. And this fire spread so quickly because there hasn't been a fire in almost a couple hundred years. So there's a lot of overgrowth, they called it decadent growth, that just helped fuel this fire really quickly. It's also difficult for firefighters to fight because it's a very difficult elevation for them to work on. There's a lot of hills and slopes, and that's actually another reason why the containment has taken so long, is that they don't have the regular situational, I guess, awareness or situation that they're used to dealing with.
Right, and I guess we've had a drought in the mountains right in here in the valley for a while, so I'm sure that didn't help. Things were pretty dry up there. And so what resources have been brought in to battle the fire? Obviously, I know this is one of the top priorities in terms of wildfires in the country for a little bit. And so who all came in and what kind of resources have been thrown at?
Yeah, it was just alphabet soup of different agencies. It was the Bureau of Land Management, Forest Service. They called it an incident one type command team. So it was essentially their highest priority. The person in charge was someone from BLM, but they were operating, I think, at the max, a fire crew of like 1,200 people from just about everywhere in the United States. I mean, there were people from Utah, everywhere from in Nevada, everywhere from kind of western states.
Mm-hmm. And now this did happen right after the 19 firefighters died in the fire in Arizona. I was wondering, did people talk about that when you were interviewing firefighters? Were people sort of extra aware of safety and not putting themselves in positions where they couldn't retreat? I mean, did that have any factor in sort of what commanders were saying to their firefighters and anything like that?
Yeah, again, because a lot of the fire containment strategy, this one was just trying to figure out which areas can we stop it from spreading into. So a lot of the firemen were working on, you know, prevention lines, that kind of thing. In Prescott, when the 19 hotshots died, that was a very different situation. That was more of an open area. The fire was moving a lot faster. This fire was massive, but there wasn't really that kind of situation. Again, they were very concerned about safety. I'm sure they didn't want to repeat that same thing. They gave media a safety presentation a couple of days ago, but I think there was one injury from the fire related to dehydration, and that was it.
Well, that's good. That's good to hear. And what were some of the other challenges in terms of getting to where were some areas harder to fight than others? What are the roads like up there? What were some of the other challenges they faced?
Yeah, right now, the biggest challenge is this area that they're calling the Goat Rocks. They call it that because it's so steep, they say only a goat can kind of jump and get up that way. They're saying it's way too difficult to establish any kind of prevention line or to get firefighters up there. I think one guy told me like they'd have to dangle them from helicopters if they really wanted them to fight the fire. And that's the area that's still uncontained as of now, and they're planning to just let that burn. But again, it's that kind of elevation and the kind of climate on Mount Charleston that's difficult to deal with.
Mm-hmm. And now there was rain and sort of more moisture over the weekend, and that sort of helped contain some of the flames, right, but also made things more precarious. How did that go over the weekend when we had some thunderstorms?
Yeah, the monsoon rains that were coming in kind of saved the day for the firefighters. I mean, it was at like 15% containment, then got bumped down, and as soon as those rains started coming in, it really helped the firefighters out in terms of, you know, keeping these flames down a little bit, letting them get close enough to where they could fight it. I mean, before that, they had these walls of fire that were going up 150 feet because it was just all these giant trees and whatnot. That also did lead to the possibility of flash floods, which might have slowed them down a little bit. But I think on the whole, the monsoon season and rain really helped them out a lot.
On Friday, though, they had like what a debris flow, they were calling it. That did that stop the firefighters?
It might have delayed them temporarily, but again, it was a lot more helpful than it did harm.
And in some of those areas, are they using helicopters? Like, what are they using on the fire when, you know, in terms of where the firefighters can't just walk up or get there easily? What are they doing to keep it contained?
Mainly air support. There's planes and helicopters coming all the way out from California or staying in Nevada. That's where a lot of the cost has been. There's been like a number bandied around, like more than $10 million has been spent fighting this fire. Mm-hmm. Large percentage of that is refueling the responding aircraft, so it's helicopters, planes, and all that.
Mm-hmm. Who's paying for that yet? I mean, is it federal money, Clark County money, combination?
It's a combination of them. Yeah. We're going to get more details as they come out. Again, their biggest concern over the last 2 weeks has been, how do we stop the fire?
Right.
And we're going to see more on the environmental impact, how it's going to affect residents, and the fiscal cost of this, because, again, this is probably the largest fire in Clark County since it's been settled by white people in the 1800s.
Wow. And speaking of residents and settlers and all that, how many homes, buildings did we lose any residences or?
There were 6 structures lost in Prospect Ranch. It wasn't the most populous area. I think there was 1 commercial building and a couple of other structures that were lost. That was earlier in the week. Residents of Kyle Canyon had the fire come very, very close to their home, just a couple hundred feet, but no structures were lost there. Population of that area is probably going to be around like 500 mm-hmm. people, and they were very happy they didn't have as much structural loss.
Right, and talk a little about the evacuations. Where did people go? Sort of what were the arrangements? You know, how did the residents respond? Were most pretty cooperative and understanding of?
Yeah, there was some backlash. Again, there were 1 or 2 people who didn't want to leave, and there was a story in the Review Journal yesterday. I don't know if you saw it, saying, when is a mandatory evacuation mandatory? Because the governor didn't issue an evacuation order. People could stay, but it didn't make a lot of sense to, because that fire was coming really close. But in terms of evacuation, I mean, they were having community meetings almost every day for 2 weeks. They're keeping people kind of on top of things. Just the general sense I got from going to those was that people understood the necessity of it. They just weren't happy because they didn't get to go home for 2 weeks.
Right. So were most people staying in shelters? Did most people find, you know, relatives or hotels to stay in?
Most people had relatives in hotels. Again, this is a very, I don't want to judge anyone, but it's kind of like a wealthy subdivision. A lot of the houses there are vacation homes, that kind of thing. So that they weren't like in shelters, and the American Red Cross was there to support anyone who needed help.
And how many people do you know stayed on the mountain and didn't evacuate and stayed in their homes?
It was just a handful. There was 1 or 2 people who were doing it. Again, I don't know why they did. They had the right to.
Right.
I guess most services were still on the mountain. Electricity. There was some issue with water, internet, and cell reception, but. That was it.
And now residents are returning to their home now. Are most of them back in their homes?
Residents of, I think, Lee, Trout, and another subdivision were able to go home on Monday. On Wednesday, residents of Kyle Canyon, which is the largest population center that was affected, that's about 300 people, they'll be able to go home Wednesday morning. And then they say tentatively now they're going to open up the entire mountain to the public and the media Friday morning.
Does that mean in terms of like trails will be reopened and people can actually go up there and do like the recreational activities?
Yeah, that's the plan. Like they'll still have, I'm sure, some areas marked off. There's still going to be a heavy presence there. Again, they're transitioning from that larger command type I talked about earlier to a very smaller one that's more locally controlled. But they will still have a presence there while they're waiting for the fire to go out. But for the most part, most of the trails and things are going to be open. I know yesterday all the trails on Red Rock that were affected have been reopened. So it's opening back up.
And how much containment is there of the fire now at this point?
As of today, it's at 80% containment.
And, at some point though, they figured that they won't be able to get to 100% containment, right? There's certain areas that they just won't get to and can't, you know, put out the fire, right?
Yeah, the really inaccessible areas, they're saying that's the part they can't contain. So What I was told yesterday is they're going to get to 90% containment and then just kind of wait the whole thing out.
Mm-hmm. And so they're moving. They've been set up at Centennial High School. I guess obviously it made it easy that school was out. And so they've been set up there. And now they're going to move operations to some other location. Now.
Yeah, they didn't know where they're moving to yet. Again, that's the new incident command team's kind of issue to deal with. They're transitioning them over on throughout Thursday and officially on Friday. So they're definitely in the process of downscaling. Crews are already been leaving, and it's in the waiting stages.
And so we had 1,200 people on the fire at its site, and how many people are here now today?
I don't know. Over the last couple of days, I'd say around 800 to 700 still here, but they're getting ready to go home.
Mm-hmm. And so now you mentioned that we don't really see fires like this, once 100, 200 years. Will this make, in terms of moving forward, does this decrease the chance of, bad fires in the future moving forward?
Yeah, I did talk to a couple of environmental analysts about the fire, and they said that in kind of the low-lying areas, it's going to take about 3 to 5 years for it to get back to the state it was before the fire. So that's about 3 to 5 years they'll have of pretty good fire protection. But in the upper areas, the part that's burning right now, the part that's been so difficult to deal with, it's going to take anywhere from 50 to 100 years for that to get back to how it was before the fire. Now, that's bad because obviously there's that environmental impact, but that also means there probably is not going to be a fire of this size for another 50 or 100 years getting up to those kind of inaccessible areas. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the silver lining they were trying to push.
Right. And what are they doing now in terms of the areas that were contained? Is there still smoldering areas? I mean, what are they doing sort of backfill in terms of going over areas? What were the processes? Now it's kind of contained. What are firefighters working on?
Again, they're working on prevention lines for the areas that are still on fire and can still present a risk. They're doing that backfill, like you said, looking for hot spots. They were telling us how they'll go through dirt and they'll put their hand above the dirt to make sure it's not warm so it can't re-spark. Again, there's not too much of that work to do on the side of the fire that's closest to Pahrump, where I went last week. They really didn't have too much to do. They've got all that pretty much contained.
Mm-hmm. And now, in moving forward, I know there was concerns about the Mount Charleston blue butterfly and other animals that live up there. And I think so. There's a certain chipmunk that is native to the Spring Mountains and specifically our area. I mean, what do we do moving forward in terms of will there be federal services here in terms of making sure that those populations come back? And what's the conservation outlook?
Again, that remains to be seen. Talking to the environmental impact guys, they said it might turn out being okay because they kind of cleared a lot of that overgrowth, a lot of that brush that was in the way. They said it's going to help predators a little bit more than prey, but it's still, I think it's still very early in that process.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us, Riley. We've been talking with Riley Snyder from the Las Vegas Sun about the Carpenter One fire. And now joining us in the studio is Paul De Los Santos. He's a business researcher for the Las Vegas Sun. Thanks for joining us, Paul. On July 3rd, there was a soccer game at Sam Boyd Stadium between two Mexican rivals from the Chivas of Guadalajara and Club America from Mexico City. And now, Paul, you previewed the game, and I was just wondering, what's the history between these teams? Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, this is one of the longest-standing rivalries in Mexico. It's probably over 100 years old. They've been they're two most successful teams, so imagine, the Lakers and the Celtics going at it and multiplying that intensity and passion by 100, 150, or whatever you want to put a number on it. But, there's been brawls. I mean, both these fan bases really don't like each other, and I think it also stems from a philosophical difference. You have Chivas, which only takes homegrown players, and Club America, who will seek out some of the best players in the world for their team. So it really creates this juxtaposition of here's one team who buys its talent and another team that's hardworking and really supports training and all that other good stuff when it comes to sports. But, when you get two of these teams with such an impassioned rivalry, it's kind of a powder keg to begin with as it is. So it's going to be it's always a fun match. And this was technically a friendly, which wasn't very friendly because we had four players ejected before we even got through the 20th minute. So obviously there was already some intense emotions tied to this game before it even kicked off.
Right. And I guess so in the parking lot before the game, a bus full of Chivas fans were entering the parking lot. And just at that time, there was a huge crowd, over 100 America fans. And so a brawl broke out, I think, at 7 o'clock, which was a full hour before kickoff of the game. And that's sort of the atmosphere that started under. And apparently then roads were blocked. Fans had a hard time getting to the game. Many fans didn't show up until halftime. By that point, four players had been ejected. And then at this point, there were some security issues that came up. We heard that fans were basically able to bring anything they wanted to in the stadium. We saw bottles of liquor, I think.
Fireworks.
Fans were shooting fireworks off in the stadium. And there were a lot of reports of just no frisking, checking people out at the games. Now obviously this raised a lot of issues of security. And I was wondering, I know Mexico, I think, has been taking a look at their security procedures. And I think their Congress is suggesting a few moves. And so what are they looking at in Mexico right now in terms of security games? Well,
let me preface that by saying, first, these two teams have fought before on the field in the 80s. And, a lot of fights do occur between Mexican teams, which is something that they need to solve. And it always stems around alcohol. It seems that alcohol sales are really or drinking before a game are seems to be the big part of why these brawls and fights happen. So some of the things Mexico's looking at is one of the big ones is, they got to find a cutoff time for alcohol. I mean, 55th minutes, they think they're trying to look at. Some places are 45th, halftime. Other places will be 60th minute. It really comes down to you just need to cut off the alcohol. It's like a baseball game. They cut you off in the seventh inning, something like that. Maybe taking a couple breathalyzers to make sure people are at least somewhat sober.
When they enter the stadium.
When they enter the stadium, and maybe I know congestion in Mexico is probably a problem, so not a lot of people are probably going to be driving, but still, for safety purposes, even after the game, take a breathalyzer. And most importantly, I think limiting where you drink. I think if you're able to take your alcohol to your seat, and especially if it's a bottle, it gives you a weapon, basically, to toss onto the field and discuss, but a plastic cup, I think they need to contain them to just a beer garden type of area where you can only have your beer here. Now, does that promote binge drinking? Maybe, but, you can only limit it by how many drinks you can hold rather than, I'm going to go put these back in my seat, go grab two more, and then you load it up for five next 40 minutes. So
right.
Those are just some of the things. And I think if they can curb drinking and kind of keeping guys not aggressive with alcohol, I think they'll be fine in terms of being able to control how many fights break out, because fights will unfortunately happen. I mean, there's just so many emotions tied to this game. I don't think there's anything in the United States right now that really can match the emotion that many of these countries attach with soccer. I think it's difficult for us to understand. I think the closest thing we have is the Raiders-Niners stabbing, I think, a few years ago. But it's really difficult to see a rivalry take it to the point where people are beaten close to death. I think it's very difficult to comprehend in America compared to, let's say, in England or Ireland and Spain, where these types of fights have happened and they're kind of like numb to it, and it's part of soccer culture, unfortunately.
Right. And obviously we did it. I know you're a Bay Area fan. We did have the Giants Dodgers fight that left.
Yep.
Was it Brian Stowe?
It was a fan.
He was in a coma for a while. I think one person told me that where you might have one fan versus one fan in a lot of American sports, they might get into a scuffle. A lot of these fan groups for soccer are organized, and then you have organized groups with leadership, and when they start fighting, then you have a much bigger problem on your hands. And that's kind of what happened at the game on July 3rd at Sam Boyd, where at the end of the game, I believe Chivas scored. There was still 5 minutes to go, and fans ran on the field. There was complete mayhem. People on the field, people getting their faces bashed in and knocked unconscious.
It became a riot, essentially, after that one goal was scored and they had to call the game, which is rare because they want to play it out. But, it was for safety reasons. I think the Club America side didn't want to come out of their locker room until after the stadium had cleared out for media interviews. So it was really just a crazy situation, and it was unfortunate that it happened.
Right. And that was one of the issues with not tight enough security, because then people who did bring bottles into the game against the rules, use them as weapons. Now, and I know in England, we mentioned sort of limiting where you can drink, and I know in England that they have obviously much stricter rules with their hooligans, but I think you can only drink in the concourse area. So you can't watch the game and drink at the same time. So I guess it gives you a choice.
And not only that, soccer being the type of game it is, there are no breaks, so you don't want to miss any of the action because for drinking, so you want to be back at your seat. So naturally, you'll finish your beer and get back to the game as soon as possible.
Right, right. And there were some fights in Mexico between not involving these teams' fans before they ever came for this, you know, sort of quote-unquote friendly game. So there was some signs even in the months heading up to this that there might be some fights. Now, you looked at the possibility of, you know, obviously Vegas is always looking to have a professional sports team here. That's one thing we're lacking in terms of entertainment. And you looked into the possibilities of MLS before the game happened. Well, what were people saying before this game happened?
They liked Las Vegas. I mean, their MLS has always viewed Las Vegas as a potential market just because they see potential and they would love to be the first professional sports team here in Las Vegas. Now, there's a lot of issues, primarily a stadium, primarily ownership group. But if those two things come into play, you know, MLS on expansion possibly can look at it. I mean, the biggest one is, you know, they're just looking for a team that has all the amenities that can be, that could be something great for U.S. soccer, because you're no longer joining the MLS. You're a part of the U.S. soccer or North American Soccer Federation, where if Las Vegas was to have a really good stadium, not only are they hosting an MLS team, they'll have possibility of hosting like U.S. qualifiers, U.S. home games. So it's really one of those things where it's not just you're getting into the MLS, you're also buying into the U.S. Franchising of soccer. So, you know, they really like the location. They feel that it can be one of their big markets, and it just comes down to how well a stadium and a franchisee is willing to bring one here. They're not looking to expand at the moment, but, you know, maybe 5-10 years down the road, it could happen. But, you know, things like what happened on July 3rd, while they're bad, it, in the long term, it probably is not going to be that bad, because, you know, you look at these MLS games, all their supporter groups, they have strict bylaws of saying against, you are not going to attack a fan, or else you not only give us a bad name, you give the entire team a bad name. So there's really this outline for, you know, be a fan, cheer hard, but do not fight. And number two, they'll keep the two sides separate. I mean, if you look at how MLS stadiums are built, you have a couple sections for supporters, and then you put the away supporters in their own little hole. I think it's behind their own goal in the second half. So you really, I don't think a fight like this would happen with MLS teams, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Right. And we should point out that while there were six people injured at the Chivas America game, or at least taken to the hospital, and then 9 incident reports, but no arrests made by Metro Police or any other. There were a lot of other police there, Henderson Police, UNLV Police. But then they did step up security for a following game between a team from El Salvador, I think El Firpo?
Yeah, Firpo.
And Monarcas from Mexico. They had fewer fans. It's not a natural rivalry, but they had, I think, more security than they had at the other game, which had way more people. And there were no incidents. I believe that game went out without a hitch. But
well, there was a minor incident, I believe, where fans from Firpo weren't allowed to bring in their instruments, which caused a little, you know.
Right, that gets into these organized groups, right? I think they had drums,
yeah,
right?
They had drums, and everyone, like, I think they missed the mark a little bit. Like, they need to just check if there's fireworks inside the drum.
Right.
You know, it's just one of those things where you don't have to ban the drum. You just need to check the drum.
Right. Is it? I mean, I'm sure it's difficult too. They're not used to policing soccer games here, and that sort of fine line between the safety of everyone and allowing fans to do what they traditionally do and support their teams and have good fun. You know. And the same, I was wondering about stadium. You know, Sam Boyd, I've been there. It's not the nicest stadium in the
world. I've been there a lot, too.
MLS has moved towards soccer-specific stadiums, right? Is that a big hold up, you know, in terms of what they're looking for when they look at cities?
Yes and no. They just need a stadium, primarily. That's the big one, because stadiums, it doesn't have to be soccer-specific, because if you look at Seattle as probably the best example, the MLS spokesman I talked to, I think, is Dan Countermush. It's like a French name, so I butchered that name. But he basically said if Seattle was to have a soccer-specific stadium, they'd be leaving a lot of money on the table, because they pack CenturyLink Field. They take a football stadium, pack 23,000 fans. A typical soccer specific will range anywhere between 12, 15, 18, even 20. I think that's the StubHub Center in Carson, California for the LA Galaxy. So a soccer specific stadium isn't necessarily needed, but they just need a stadium that will have a good soccer configuration and really bring intimacy to the game, which is what the MLS has really strived for, is because it really wants to bring fans closer to the game and expose them to some, you know, good soccer.
Right. Do you think Sam Boyd would work, or do we need a new stadium in town for this to really work?
I think I agree with what Tim Lucy said, the promoter of this game. He said Sam Boyd is a good temporary location, but they need a stadium. They're going to need a really specific, not even soccer specific, they just need a new stadium that can fit, that isn't feel so that doesn't feel so cavernous when you're playing, because if you think about 36,000 at Sam Boyd, that thing doesn't fill up. You know, it's going to feel a little empty. I mean you can configure whatever the new stadium, whatever it is, UNLV Now, Majestic's off campus idea, whatever the stadium plan is, you can change the configuration around, tarp off some sides and really put something intimate and make it good. So Sam Boyd would be good for like the 3 years they're building. If they say, okay, we'll wait for a stadium to be built, then Sam Boyd would make a temporary home, but I don't think it's the home for a soccer team.
Well, maybe, I guess there are a lot of stadium projects that people are talking about.
Way too many.
Yeah, so I don't know, maybe they can work out something. This would be a good market for, maybe a good market for soccer. Obviously, we have a large Hispanic population, I think 700,000 just in Clark County, and the soccer leagues keep getting more popular. So it's a possibility, right?
It's always a possibility, because the MLS is always looking to expand it. I don't think they're just looking to expand just to say to MLS. I think they're trying to get a second tier league, kind of like what they have in other countries where you have the top class and then you have the second class and people are fighting for trying to get into the top class. Mm-hmm. I think ultimately, now I'm not going to say that's going to be within the next 15 years. I think that's the long-term goal for the MLS, is to have this tier system kind of like all the other countries. But one of the things the MLS spokesman pointed out was North America is a very, very wide country. It's a very, very wide country compared to like England or compared to Spain. And, you know, there's a lot of different geographic challenges. So they're going to look really hard at, you know, right now they're looking for the Southeast. Mm-hmm. I think that's their next expansion locate goal. They're going to add another team in New York, which I think is fine since New York is that big. They only have one team. So if there's one area other than California that can support two teams, it's New York. And they're at 20 right now. I think 24 will probably be the number, I would say, in the next 10 years. And maybe Las Vegas can get one of those teams, because there is right now an imbalance between the Eastern and Western Conference.
Do you think Vegas, I mean, is there the interest here to follow a sport? I mean, obviously you're a sports junkie. You know, we get people to come out for UNLV basketball games, but not UNLV football games. The 51s are kind of struggling. What, I mean, do people want to go to these events here?
I think it's going to come down to bringing a good product. I think that's ultimately what it is, because if you think about UNLV basketball, when they weren't good before Lon Cougar came in, they were still averaging about 10,000, 11,000. I mean, there were still 10,000, 11,000 people, but it's nowhere near what it is now, where season tickets are, you know, are sold out, and every game is around 18,000 people. It comes down to talent, because UNLV football hasn't been good. I mean,
right.
I went to school there, just has not been good at all. And
right.
51s, I think it's a downtown. I think it's a stadium problem with the 51s. I think they'd get more fans, because they are doing pretty well this year. I think they're competing for the PCL title. It's just the stadium area is just scares off a lot of people. If they move to Summerlin, maybe that changes. Who knows? I mean, that's a lot of speculation right now. But as for an MLS team, it comes down to getting a good product. If they're good, people will come out. And I think there's a nice fan base. I think people will say, you know, go look at the Crown and Anchor on Premier League mornings. I mean, there's a decent amount of people on World Cup time. And, you know, there's a lot of people here who love soccer. I think, you know, problem is same thing, transient town. But if you give them something collected to root for, something to adopt, and it's good, they'll come out. I mean, you can easily build have the configuration set around 13,000, I think you'll be safe. And then with the possibility of expanding to 18, I think that's the safe number if you're looking for attendance and, you know, keep costs down and all that other stuff that runs with a franchise. But, yeah, I think Las Vegas would support an MLS team.
Yeah, well, people like winners, right? So if you got a winner, that should work. Well, thanks for joining us, Paul. It was good. Paul De Los Santos from the Las Vegas Sun, and you've been listening to KUNV 91.5. This has been Neon Eden, and we'll see you next week.